There's track two.
Oh, okay. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay.
Okay. The date is May 10, 2006. The location is Amelia Island Museum of History on Amelia Island, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. And we are interviewing Francis Carl Reidinger, R-E-I-D-I-N-G-E-R, whom I will be calling Frank. He was born December 25th, 1939 in Shamokin, Pennsylvania, pronounced S or spelled S-H-A-M-O-K-I-N. He now lives at 1638 Regatta Drive on Amelia Island, Florida. My name is Morris E. McCaffrey, and I'm being assisted today by Robert Hamer running the equipment. So now I'll begin the interview. Frank, we have your date of birth, December 25th, 1939. When did you enter the military, and how did you go about, why did you enter the military?
Well, my plan was to go to Kent State University, and I was going to work on the ore boats on Lake Erie to earn that tuition, but I found out I was too young. So, unable to work that out, I went in the Air Force, enlisted in 1958. I took the tests and flew for the first time in my life on a commercial airplane from Cleveland, Ohio to San Antonio, Texas. And it was an all-night flight, and we were met by the very pleasant drill sergeants when we got off the bus in San Antonio, and I went through Air Force basic training there.
Was that at Lackland Air Force
Base? Lackland Air Force Base, Texas, yes. And while we were there, one of the things we did was take the aptitude tests for career fields, and I was sick that day, but they wouldn't let me excuse out, so I took the test, and they ended up deciding I should be a reciprocating engine mechanic. And I am the least handy person in the world with that kind of stuff.
Well, how did you find that training? Difficult, interesting?
No, the training was very good. I went to Chanute, C-H-A-N-U-T-E, Air Force Base in Illinois, to recent mechanics school. And the academics were typical. We would go to classes, and then we would go work on engines in the shop. And oddly enough, they pulled a bunch of us out early. We did not complete the course. And they sent us to Montana, to Malmstrom Air Force Base. And that's M-A-L-M-S-T-R-O-M. And we went to Malmstrom where we went to the engine shop half a day. And the other half a day, we completed the recip engine mechanics course.
And then... Well, we'll bounce to the end of your service. How long were you in the active military?
I did 10 years active duty and 14 reserve, so I had 24 years total.
Okay. At the termination of the end of your training for reciprocating engines training, what was the next step?
While I was a mechanic up in Montana, the team came through the base for testing to go to pilot or navigator training, and I applied to do that. That's an interesting story. The format checklist to apply for this, you had to go with the first sergeant in the orderly room. Three of us decided to do it, and the first sergeant said, well, you have to come during lunch hour. So as we're walking down the hall to do it, the other two guys said, no, we're going to go to chow. And I went, filled out the forms, and here I am. And I've always wondered what happened to those guys.
Never found out.
Never found out.
So that was the beginning of your entry into pilot training.
Yes. At that time, a matter of fact, an interesting thing about the testing was every half day they would announce the people that should not come back. So every half day that they did not call my name, I thought I just got a step closer to something. I didn't know what. And it was all over. The master sergeant in charge of the interview team said, I've got some bad news for you. And he said, you did not score well enough to be a navigator. Would you like to be a pilot? So I said, oh, yeah.
That's interesting. Not well to be a navigator. Okay, now, so that was step one in pilot training.
Yes, they still had the aviation cadet program. The aviation cadet program was a leftover from World War I and carried through World War II and Korea, and it was still alive where they were getting guys to go to flight school that did not have their college degree. I was taking night courses, but I didn't have my degree. So we went through as aviation cadets, which was a kind of a curious rank. We were like we were between an NCO and an officer, but it was just aviation cadet. And
where was that? Did you start your?
We started. I went back to Lackland and got my head shaved again. And went through the Green Monster, which was the big supply building where we got all our gear. And we had 3 months there, and they call that pre-flight. And that's where they weeded out a lot of the guys on medicals, academics, and military discipline. We always had a class system going. I went to 3 different bases as a cadet. And at each base, we had a class system. At Lackland, there were only 2 classes. So the upper class would harangue us, just like you see in the movies at the academies. And there were a lot of guys that broke, and that's what they were trying to do, find the guys that couldn't handle the
pressure,
the discipline.
Yeah. The discipline.
So we were 6 weeks as underclass, and they just gave us all kinds of stuff.
Was there a great deal of time pressure?
Yes, everything was time pressure.
Time pressure.
They blew the bugle at 5:30 in the morning, and you fell out for reveille, and they announced the dress of the day, the uniform of the day, and they announced the window setting of the day. So the windows in all the barracks were set at the same place.
Window setting.
They would announce the window setting of the day is half open or whatever. And then we'd go back to the barracks, make our bunks, clean up our rooms, clean up, put on a uniform, and go off to academics. Everything at Lackland was academics. We didn't do any flying there.
Did you learn about Air Force procedures, weather, aerodynamics?
No, we really didn't. Customs and courtesies.
Oh.
The basic Air Force type stuff, marching, drill and ceremonies, et cetera, et cetera. And these were just steps to weed people out. And we never really got into any aviation subjects at Lackland.
Then after Lackland?
After Lackland, we were sent to a primary training base, and I went to Bainbridge, B-A-I-N, Bridge Air Force Base, Georgia. And it was operated by civilians under Air Force contract. Oddly enough, Bainbridge was operated by Southern Airways.
Southern Airways.
Now, we did not have Southern Airways pilots instructing, but Southern Airways had that contract for pilot training.
And that was your introduction to the airplane
itself.
That
was introduction to the airplane. We had a half a day of academics and half a day of flying.
What airplane?
We started off and flew the T-34, which is a beach single-engine low-wing prop, and we flew that for 27 hours. And then we went to the T-37, the Cessna T-37, which was a two-engine side-by-side. The instructor sat beside you, and we flew that for about 100 hours.
And what was your impression of your initial flight training? Did you?
It was something new to me because I barely had a car. And as a matter of fact, I did not have a car when I went to pilot training. And so here I am flying this airplane around. When I soloed the T-34, and as you well know, solo was a big time, the first time, big event. I let the canopy open, and I had my scarf wrapped around my neck, and I threw my scarf out the window, and it was in January, and I flew around freezing, but I had that canopy open with the scarf out. And so we did some maneuvers, and we did the typical airworks, stalls, spins, et cetera, in the T-34, and then we went to the T-37 for jet training.
And describe for us your initial reaction to when you strapped on that first jet.
Well, the T-37 was amazing. It had two jet engines, and it was quiet, and it was fast. And the only disadvantage was the instructor sat beside you. If you messed up somewhere, he'd reach over and knock on your helmet and ask if anybody was in there. He'd reach over and grab your oxygen mask and shake it back and forth and tell you to get back on to heading, airspeed, and altitude. Of course, you couldn't see a thing. But we did everything in the T-34 except formation flying. We did aerobatics, landings, takeoffs, instrument work. They put a hood over you on the runway, and we would do an instrument takeoff and fly the whole flight, climb, cruise maneuvers, descent, and they'd never pull the hood up until you're about 200 feet above the runway, and then you'd look up and land.
Now, how did you feel about that?
I felt good. I always enjoyed instrument flight, and I still do. I really worked at it and studied at it and practiced, so instrument flight was a lot of fun.
Now, the T-37, after that, what jet?
After we did 6 months of that at Bainbridge, we went to Reese, R-E-E-S-E, Air Force Base, Texas, and we flew the Lockheed T-33. That was a single engine tandem seating jet trainer. It was a derivative of the P-80 shooting star in the Korean War.
And how'd you like that airplane?
Oh, that was hot. I mean, that thing really had the big orange fuel tip tanks on the wing, and we would fly formation now. So we would fly diamond or echelon formation, aerobatics, and plus a regular transitional aerobatic maneuvers, plus traffic pattern work, plus instruments. When you flew instruments, you sat in the back seat, and there was a cloth hood that was on rails over your head. You'd pull the cloth hood up so you couldn't see out, and we did the same thing. The instructor would line you up on a runway, and you'd make an instrument take off and fly for an hour and a half, 2 hours under the hood doing different things, including the approach to land.
And would they do unusual attitudes on you?
Unusual everything.
No, okay, after the T-33, how many hours did you fly?
We got about 125 hours in the T-33.
And then what was the next step? You get your wings then?
Being aviation cadets, we got our wings and commission at the same ceremony. So I was a brand-new second lieutenant with brand-new silver wings. Nobody from my family could come down, so I had my roommate's girlfriend pin them on me.
And how did that feel? Great. That sensation.
That was great. And then you walked out of the hall, and all the underclassmen were out there, and the first one to salute you got the silver dollar.
Silver dollar.
Which is, as you know, a good tradition.
Okay, now you have your wings and you're a second lieutenant. Did you get leave then to go home?
Got some leave, went home, and then headed for STED, STEAD, Air Force Base, Nevada, and I went through survival training there. We were still, this was a program, kind of a line from Korea. We had Oriental guards and interrogators. And we did about a week and a half in academics, and our physical training for the afternoon would be karate training. And then we went through an obstacle course at night with the flares and the barbed wire and the machine guns and everything. And at the end of the obstacle course, you turned yourself in and you went to the prisoner of war camp. So we were there about 4 days, and we lived in dugouts cut into the ground. And they had the blaring music, the searchlights. They would call us out in the middle of the night, hose us down, and search us. And then everybody got to be interviewed by these pros. And I got shot twice in POW camp. I wasn't a very good POW.
Shot?
Well, one thing they did is they put you in the box. And it was a box. You'd be on your toes, all crumpled up. And they had wooden Coca-Cola cases in them to adjust it for different sized people. And they didn't take the case out for me, so I was really crammed in there. My door was bulging, and a guy next to me started crying. And they thought it was me, and they stuck a rifle in there, with a blank, of course, and pulled the trigger. And I was kind of trying to just zero myself out, but I exploded out of there, and then they shot me again.
With another blank cartridge,
blank cartridge.
Somebody actually broke on the training? Then did anybody
else
break?
Yeah, some of the guys had a hard time with it. And then another time they fell us out in the middle of the night, and they rang the air raid siren, so all lights went out. So this navigator that was my hut mate, we went running for the fence to escape, and I put one foot on one wire and one foot on the other, and my hands on the other, pulled it up, and the lights came on, and we were right below a guard tower, and this guard looked down at us, kind of shook his head. And then he swung a 30 caliber machine gun down and fired at us. Bap, 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 of course, airplane. But I about had a heart attack on that one.
I bet you.
So I didn't do very good in POW camp.
Did anybody break up to the point that they flunked out of it?
No, they would have you go through again.
Yeah.
And then we also did, while we were at STED, then the last thing we did was E&E, escape and evasion. They took us and dumped us off someplace, and they gave us two checkpoints. So at the end of one day, you had to go to a checkpoint and check in with the partisans, and they would give you directions to the second checkpoint, and you would go to the second checkpoint and check in, and then the third day, you would end up at the bus stop to get out. And in the meantime, the instructors were looking for you. So it was in a winter up in the mountains near Reno, and we're carrying snowshoes, and instructors are chasing us. And
doesn't sound like much.
Most of us made it through.
I want to back up 1 second. I forgot to ask you. Did you have any particularly colorful type instructors you met along the way, flight instructors that were characters that you really remember?
Yes. They were all really great, really worked with us, even though we were cadets. But the one unusual was a guy named Pappy somebody. I'll think of his name. But he was afraid to spin the T-37 in the inverted spin. T-37 was really mean in a spin, and the inverted spin was ultra mean, and because you're upside down spinning, and it was really difficult to recover. You could only do it with an instructor. You were not allowed to practice it by yourselves. It was kind of a familiarization maneuver, and Pappy wouldn't do them. He would assign us to another instructor when the syllabus called for inverted spins.
Interesting. Okay, now after your survival training, what was the next step?
Then I went to Tinker Air Force Base, Oklahoma, to check out on a C-124 Globemaster. It was a four-engine transport. And that was a three-month school, going through a lot of ground school, simulator, and then flight training in that airplane.
Why were you selected for that particular aircraft?
That's a good question. I didn't include that, but when you graduated from pilot training, you were ranked. We had three areas of scores: academics, flying, and military. And I was about in the middle of my class, and the top guys got the fighters and all the glamorous stuff, and the guys in the middle got transports or bombers, and the guys at the bottom got helicopters. So when it came my turn to pick, I had tankers, bombers, transports, or helicopters. So I took the transport.
Now, the C-124, I know, is a giant aircraft. Describe it just a bit for the folks.
Well, it weighed 185,000 pounds. It was probably one of the world's largest piston engine airplanes, second to the B-36 maybe. It had four of the largest mass-produced reciprocating engines they made, the R-4360. The R-4360 had 28 cylinders on each engine. And it flew unpressurized at about 175 knots indicated around the world, and that's what I did.
And what was your cruising altitude typically?
Well, being unpressurized, we normally stay below 10. Yeah.
What was your reaction? I mean, that's to flying that thing from...
Well, the Air Force was not very smart in those days. They have since changed. We were all trained to be fighter pilots, single-engine jet, aerobatics, formation, et cetera, et cetera. And then I go into this long-range transport. So it was quite a change going to that type of flying. But I think that's kind of what I wanted to do. I think I eventually wanted to maybe be an airline pilot or just do some good flying. I didn't do well in pilot training and aerobatics. Every time we flew aerobatics, I got sick. Mm. And what happened, I'd get sick. When we were done, we'd do all these maneuvers, and he'd pull the throttle off, and we always terminated by gliding back to the airport and doing a simulated flame-out landing. And he had to recite a emergency start checklist and then go through your drill of getting on a high key over the airport in a low key, a position to beam the airport and making it to the runway with no thrust. And I could do that while I was finishing up my sickness and folding my bag and put it back in my pocket and flying with the stick between my knees and everything. And I remember my instructor said, "Mr. Ridinger," he said, "I'd wash you out, but you do the best single or simulated flame out pattern of any of my students." So that got me through. So I kind of knew I didn't want to be a fighter pilot.
Now, C-124, where did you fly that airplane? Describe that.
I was based in Donelson Air Force Base in South Carolina and flew worldwide. But we also had a rotational squadron in Frankfurt, Germany, at Rhein Main, R-H-E-I-N-M-A-I-N, air base in Germany. And we'd go there 90 days a year and fly throughout Europe, Africa, and the Near East.
Did you fly in and out of Vietnam? Was there a period of time when you were flying?
Yeah, later on. Later on, we did Vietnam. Going back to being in Germany initially, yeah. We flew Berlin Corridor. The first thing we did was get qualified in Berlin Corridor procedures, and in case there was another Berlin airlift. So this was maybe 12, 15 years after the Berlin airlift, so we stayed trained on how to fly in there. We got buzzed by a MiG.
I was going to ask you if ever had an interference.
Yeah, the Russians jammed our radios. It was a real experience.
So now, after the C-124, you made many, many flights. How many hours did you have in the C-124?
Oh, I probably got about 6,000 hours in the 124. And some of the things we did with it, well, for instance, I talked about flying to Berlin. I happened to be there on August 13th, 1961, the day they started building the Berlin Wall. That was the day we flew our Berlin Corridor checkout. and they took us on a tour of the, and we went down to Checkpoint Charlie, and they had finally blocked it off. They were not letting people cross. And there was a grandfather there who was crying because his daughter and granddaughter were coming from East Berlin to see him, and the Russians wouldn't let him up close. And there was a life photographer there, and I asked the life photographer if this grandfather could use his long-range lens to see his granddaughter and daughter, and he did. The guy was crying. It was really sad. But that was at Checkpoint Charlie the day they started building the wall.
Well, you had many other locations I see here on your sheet. Saigon, Dominican Republic.
Yes, we came back. When we were back in the States, we flew everywhere. I was gone 270 days of the year at TDY, temporary duty around the world. Matter of fact, I was up at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, when my son was born. So I missed the birth of my first son. And then we started to fly in Vietnam before people knew what it was. And we would haul stuff in, supplies. It was troops and cargo. And nobody knew where Vietnam was then. I remember we had a squadron party, and we had a navigator who gambled with his per diem. We got $15 a day, I believe it was, per diem. And that was for meals and whatever. And he would gamble with that, and his wife didn't know about it. And at the squadron party, she had heard the word, and I was standing by this guy, and she asked him, "What is per diem?" And without blinking an eye, he said, "That's the capital of South Vietnam." So, but then it picked up. It picked up, and then we started doing a lot of flying to Vietnam. In the meantime, I flew to the Dominican Republic when they overthrew Trujillo. And I don't know how to spell that, but he was the leader there. And we flew to the Belgian Congo. That was interesting. When the Belgians were withdrawing from Leopoldville, Belgian Congo, which became Kinshasa, Zaire, and I can't spell that either. But Mau Mau were coming back in, and they were killing Belgians. So we flew in, and we were flying these civilians out from the Congo, and that was interesting.
We'll continue with your sequence then after that.
And then I was one of the first airplanes into Cuba when we had the blockade, and that was interesting. We flew a load of, I think it was fuel can, 55-gallon drums of fuel, and we had to spend a night. And I stayed in the barracks in the officers' quarters, and the guy across the hall was the Marine major in charge of security. And he took me down and showed me where the fence was, where the Cubans were. But he told me an interesting story. They had evacuated all dependents months ago. So these Marines were there without their wives. And the Cubans would come down to the fence with a blanket and a couple of women and kind of do things to make the Marines very angry. So the Marines were throwing rocks at them. Well, the Cubans learned to move the blankets further back. Well, then the Marines made slingshots. And this guy's saying, "Can you believe it? World War III may start because we have a better slingshot." But then, as we all know, Cuba worked out okay.
This, of course, the U.S. base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Cuba, yeah, Gitmo. Exactly. Another interesting trip for Kennedy. John Kennedy flew to Nassau to meet with Macmillan of England, I believe, and Diefenbaker of Canada. And so I got to see him in Air Force One. We carried all his radio comm gear. Wherever the president goes, he takes his vehicles and a whole bunch of comm gear. So we carried that to Nassau with him. And
that's communications gear, Frank.
I'm sorry, yes, communications gear, yes, I'm sorry. Another mission we had was taking nuclear bombs. We would pick them up at the overhaul factory up in Seneca, New York, on the Fingers Lakes. And they would overhaul. A bomb needs to be overhauled. It's like a piece of machinery. I didn't realize that. And we would take them typically to Germany somewhere, maybe Bitburg or somewhere in Germany. But Seneca was a real small field, and we couldn't launch over the North Atlantic from there. So we would go pick up the bombs, unload, and then go to Griffiths Air Force Base, G-R-I-F-F-I-S, Air Force Base in New York, and spend the night and then launch the next day. Well, we were about 5 miles out on final approach, landing at Griffiths at night. And I looked down to check my instruments, and I looked it up, and the world was gone. And I told the co-pilot, I've got vertigo. You got the airplane. He said, I've got vertigo, too. I don't want it.
What spell, Frank, what's vertigo?
Vertigo is dizziness. When you get dizzy and you lose,
E-R-T-I-G-O.
Lose your balance. V-E-R-T-I-G-O. And come to find out later, it was when all the lights went out in New York.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
Fortunately, they had emergency lights.
The great blackout.
The great blackout.
And that was into
the
world.
Yeah, that
was
in 64. And they had some runway lights, so we landed. And that worked out okay eventually. And then I had another trip to St. Louis to pick up one of the space capsules. I think it was Gemini 13, but I didn't keep a log on it. But it was built by McDonald in St. Louis, and then we flew it down to the Cape. And they did not have the big runway there. They just had the JFK skid strip. And so we would fly it down, and they offloaded it and then trucked it over and put it on top of the rocket. It was the capsule itself.
The capsule itself.
So on the way down from St. Louis to the Cape, I went back to look at it and climbed up on it, got a picture of it. And so I was the first pilot on board that Gemini capsule in flight. And that's where I got the reputation of being a half-astronaut.
A half-astronaut.
That was it. Well, anyways, with a million war stories, I eventually got out of the Air Force in 66 and went with Delta Airlines. And then I flew with them till 1997. But to supplement income, when you first go at the airlines, they paid us a pittance, $550 a month. So most guys had part-time jobs. We had one guy had a paper route, a pilot. Another guy was driving a cab. Because we're making $550 a month with a family, et cetera. So a lot of guys joined the reserves or guard, and that's what I did.
Oh, yeah.
And but we got after a year and a half, we got called to active duty for a year and a half during a Pueblo, P-U-E-B-L-O, when they captured the Pueblo and the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. So we went back on active duty and flew primarily trips to Vietnam.
I want to ask you about when you were in training for Delta at $550 a month, how long did that go on, that pay scale?
Well, that was only 3 months. And so then once you finished your 3 months of training and you were on the line, you got a $50 pay raise.
$50 pay
for another year. And then after that, you're on probation so that you're not under union wages. So after that year, then you come under the contract and you start making a little better money.
Did you start flying as a co-pilot?
A flight engineer.
Flight engineer.
On a DC-6 and DC-7.
And then how long did you, Delta Airlines is a long time.
Yes, and my military flying in 1972, we got rid of our 124s and got De Havilland, D-E-H-A-V-I-L-L-A-N-D, De Havilland C-7 Caribous, and I flew that for 10 years.
A Caribou.
Caribou, C-A-R-I-B-O-U.
And what was that airplane like?
It was just a little, it was like a small 130 piston engine STOL airplane, short takeoff and landing. So we landed on the grass and short field work, dropped a lot of special forces type thing. We trained with them, Green Berets, did a lot of air. In both the 124 and the Caribou, I've done a lot of airdrops.
That's flying at low altitude over the hostile territory, isn't
it? Yeah, we would go in low and pop up and drop the troops.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. How long did you do that?
10 years.
We
had the Caribou for 10 years, then they got rid of them. And that's when I got out of the reserves. I had my 24 years, and that was enough.
So then back to regular airline flying?
I went back to regular airline flying and finally retired in 97. But in 1994... we moved to Amelia Island. We came down to visit a friend, found a lot, and built a house on Amelia. And then I commuted for 3 years back to Atlanta. And then I retired. I was here. We were looking for a retirement nest on the water near Delta Airport. So, and we fell in love with Amelia in Nassau County. And so I went into volunteerism when I came to Nassau County.
And volunteerism, you know, a lot of that. What airplane did you fly with Delta? Was it what jet?
Well, I retired off the Boeing 757-767.
How many hours total in airplanes?
I probably got about 27,000 hours.
27,000.
And I would probably have more, but I spent 3 years, 1 year with the Air Force as a simulator instructor and 3 years with Delta as a simulator instructor. And so most of the time I was in the simulators, not out flying. But that was interesting, teaching an airplane, because you really know it very well. So that was good.
So now, how long in Amelia Island did you say?
I've been here now 12 years. Moved here in 94.
Much volunteer work.
Yeah, I still fly with the Civil Air Patrol.
Describe that.
Civil Air Patrol is an auxiliary of the Air Force. They're sort of like the Coast Guard auxiliary. They're volunteers. We have an airplane owned by the Air Force, and we fly search and rescue missions. Probably 90% of the search missions within the contiguous United States are flown by the CAP. And then we also fly cadets for familiarization flights.
And that's a single-engine?
Single-engine Cessna 172.
And that's you fly that fair amount, I understand.
Yes, I do. I'm the operations officer. I've been the ops officer for 10 years.
Well, that's quite a career.
Yeah.
No doubt about that.
I've never had a real job. All I've done is fly airplanes.
And they paid you for it.
And they paid me for it.
And you loved it.
I loved it, and I can thank the United States Air Force for giving me the education and the wherewithal to be where I am today. I mean, I'm just a kid from a coal mining town, and I got to be an airline pilot and an Air Force lieutenant colonel.
Airline flying, I want to ask this question I've asked before. When you launch out over the ocean a trip to Europe at night, many of us in the back wonder what's going on in the cockpit up front at night out over the Atlantic Ocean, for example.
They have a lot to keep you busy. You're monitoring your computers, which you've already loaded, spent a lot of time loading on the ground. You're making radio calls, sending messages on weather. They kind of make work to keep you busy, and you have all the reports to fill out. So they keep you busy, and on a long flight, the pilots will take turns taking a nap. Just kind of sit back a little bit and take a little cat nap.
Well, now, any remarkable incidents in your airline flying you could talk about? Interesting escapades, if you will?
Beside the standard flying you can imagine with the airline, I think one of the interesting things I got to do, because I was in a training department as a simulator instructor and a check pilot, was I got to go to Seattle and bring back new airplanes. And I would go out there with the promissory note in my pocket and go fly the airplane with the Boeing pilots, an acceptance flight, sort of like taking a car out with the salesman. And when everybody was happy with everything, another pilot would come out, and we would fly the airplane back empty.
Now, you'd pay Boeing for the airplane out there, do I understand that
correctly?
Well,
yeah, I had a promissory note. It was all negotiated. It was all – timing was very important. I had one airplane. They said, be sure and pick this up on this date because we're selling it tomorrow. So the day after we got the airplane back, they sold it, and then they leased it. I mean, it was amazing the things they did.
What price?
I don't know. At the time, the 7.5s were selling for $47 million, and the 7.67s were $54 million. But there are a lot more now.
A lot more now. Well, Frank, thank you very much. That's a very, very fascinating career.
Right.
Anything else you'd like to add to that?
Nope. I just thank the Air Force and thank Amelia Island and Nassau County for letting me live here.
Well, we thank you very much for the interview.
All right.